It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Trey, thank you for joining us for a Thursday edition of our podcast. We are grateful that you would join us and loan us your time and that you would send us your questions. It's one of the highlights. As you know, Mary Langston, because you travel with my wife and I, she doesn't really ask me that many questions. I get a lot of like commands to do things, but in terms of like questions, I don't get that many. So I look forward to this podcast. Some weeks it's the only questions I get. Other than why did you do that?
No, we don't believe that, but we do appreciate their questions. They always have us thinking for sure. And then your responses have me thinking even more. So there's a lot there.
Well, you're doing more thinking in 1 week than I've done so far my entire life, if you're doing all that thinking, but thank you. The questions do make me think, and thinking is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
We should do more of that.
We should do more of it.
It's actually not a bad idea. I don't want to be too like revolutionary, but it's actually not a bad idea to think before we speak.
Mm.
No, that's kind of revolutionary, isn't it?
It is. And yeah. I mean, we could just end the podcast with that. That's a wise
radical
statement.
That's radical. Yeah, let's don't do that.
Right. I know we have a lot of great questions today. We have 4, I believe, today. So you ready to get started, Trey?
I will. And I will be a good steward of everyone's time and not take my normal 45 minutes, which is that was your subtle way of saying do not take forever because we have 4
no.
of them. I can read not only body language, but I can read language over Zoom.
No, not at all. People actually write in it when you say things like that, and they're like, don't shorten your answer. Please answer it fully. So I know there's people out there that really do listen and take what you say to heart. So
we'll
keep
tell
it
my
up.
Mom, thank you. And I'll keep trying.
All right. That sounds like a plan. Well, thank y'all for sending us your questions each week. Like Trey said, we always look forward to Thursdays. We'll start with a question from Chris, who writes, if we were a fly on the wall during SCOTUS deliberations on the Trump ballot case, what do you think we would have heard and how much time would it have?
So if I hear this right, if we were a fly on the wall, well, I can tell you right now, the first thing you would have heard is my wife telling me to go get a fly swatter because she cannot, she cannot abide a fly being inside our house. So, I mean, watching that tiny woman trying to swat flies with like a washcloth or something. Oh my heavens. I think they mean that like proverbially, right? Like fly on the wall, like in there. Okay.
Not an actual fly.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm a literalist. So, all right. What would we have heard? We would have, first of all, I think there's a lot more collegiality. Well, I know there is. There's a lot more collegiality on these appellate courts than we might think, particularly given the ideological divide, particularly given the political divide in our country. I don't know any of the Supreme Court justices well. I've met probably 4 of them, I guess. Maybe 5. I do know judges on other appellate courts, including state Supreme Courts, and they get along very well. Now, their opinions sometimes indicate a level of divisiveness and vitriol that frankly doesn't exist when they're meeting. So the way it usually works is, you know, oral argument has almost, I mean, I hate to let the cat out of the bag, but oral argument is fun to listen to, but it has, I would say, next to no significance in terms of the opinion they reach. These are some of the smartest lawyers in the world. They hire some of the smartest law students in the world to help them read briefs. So you are reading hours and hours and hours worth of written persuasion only to then lead into a very short period of question and answer time. So lots of the work is not done during oral argument. So I'll bet you they take kind of a preliminary vote before they go out for oral argument and say kind of, how are you leaning if we had to vote right now before oral argument? I mean, they're pretty careful. They don't take a hard and fast vote because you want to be open-minded. But you can tell by the questions asked that they're really not requests for information. It's not me saying, hey, Mary Langston, what time is it? These are more leading questions. They are trying to actually take the lawyer either for Colorado or the lawyer for former President Trump or any of the what we call amici or friends of the court who issue briefs and want to also argue. They're trying to take them in a certain direction. On this particular, the result was 9-0. The opinions were more fractured. So if you read the opinions, the result, it's like a football team that wins 9-0, but there's a lot of arguing on the sidelines. And the argument is about whether or not the court needed to go as far as it went or should have gone farther than it went. You could argue all they needed to say was Colorado in this fact pattern. That was the case in front of them. Colorado in this fact pattern, you cannot take Donald Trump off the ballot because we don't have 50 different versions of presidential qualification. The Constitution says you have to be a certain age. And I think it says you have to be, a natural-born citizen or however they phrase the citizenship. Those are the qualifications to be the president. Then we come up with this 14th Amendment, which some people read another qualification related to insurrection. But where the justices agree is that you don't need states deciding that. Where I think things get interesting, it's kind of Dobbs in reverse. Remember, Dobbs, which was the abortion decision, took an issue that had been federalized and sent it back to the states. This is the reverse of that. This is an issue that states want to weigh in on that the Supreme Court says, no, this is uniquely federal. And it makes sense that it would be uniquely federal. So you hear, if you were a fly on the wall, you would hear a lot of conversation about whether or not the opinion should be more narrow, more broad sweeping. Do we want to just decide the facts of this case and wait for another state to do the same thing that has potentially different facts? Or this is the conundrum, if you will. Courts are supposed to decide the dispute that is in front of them. They're not supposed to issue advisory opinions. They're not supposed to anticipate, hey, this might come up next week. Why don't we say something about that? That's not what they're supposed to do. But these opinions have precedential value. Other courts look to them and have to follow them. So you don't want to just take such a narrow view of the facts that you're going to have another case. Because let me just tell you right now, even a mediocre lawyer can find a factual distinction. You don't have to be a good lawyer to say, but Your Honor, the facts aren't exactly the same in this case. And bad lawyers can do that. Really, really good lawyers, which are the ones that appear before the Supreme Court, they can do that in their sleep. So you want to signal, don't bring similar cases because it will be a similar result. I would encourage people, 9-0 is great. Do not minimize the fact that they were unanimous, but also, maybe read a little bit into that the court does not want to find itself. Are you old enough to remember Bush v. Gore, Mary Langston?
Mm-hmm. You'll have to remind me of that. I'm not sure. I don't recognize it.
No, that was a Supreme Court case from when? When did Bush run against Gore? That was that 2000? 2004?
So I would have been here for sure. I just wasn't paying attention to it, I guess.
barely. I got to get my president. So Clinton, you know, Clinton beat George H.W. Bush, and he served two terms. And then it was Gore versus George W. Bush. And the Supreme Court kind of decided the Florida hanging Chad question. So the Supreme Court got involved in presidential politics. That's the critique. That's the criticism. I don't think this court wants to get involved in that. I think Amy Coney Barrett in particular wants to depoliticize the court. But look, you've got states kicking the leading candidate, right now the only candidate, the presumptive nominee, off the ballot. And you've got this presidential immunity issue that is before the court. So the court is being thrust into these political and quasi-political matters, and I really don't think they want to find themselves there. So if you're a fly on the wall, how do we do our jobs without becoming more politicized than we currently are? And how do we remain this institution that even if people don't like us, they respect us? I think that's what we would have heard if we had been a fly on the wall and my wife wasn't clerking for one of the justices and went and got a fly swatter to get rid of the fly.
Well said, Trey. Thank you for answering that question. And thank you, Chris, for it. We'll answer more of your questions when we come back.
Hey, it's Clay Travis. Join me for Outkick the Show as we dive deep into a mix of topics. New episodes available Monday to Friday on your favorite podcast platform and watch directly on outkick.com/watch.
Our next question is from Leon in Michigan, who writes, with all of his pending charges, how can he run for president? Should he win? What happens to those charges? Do they disappear?
Leon from the great state of Michigan, you are presumed innocent. Doesn't matter who you are. Doesn't matter what the charge is. Interestingly enough, in some states, if you are indicted, you can be removed from office. An indictment, keep in mind, is a finding of probable cause. It takes probable cause to be indicted or arrested. It takes beyond a reasonable doubt to be convicted. Some states view the charge alone as being sufficiently disqualifying, but the qualifications to run for president are, you know, as we just discussed in question number one, either two or three, depending on how you view it. You got to be a certain age, you got to meet the citizenship requirement, and then you got the 14th Amendment, however you interpret the insurrection clause. Those are the three qualifications. Even if you are in a state where you cannot vote for yourself for president, that does not mean you cannot be the president. So not only can you run for president with pending charges, I think you can run for president with convictions, because our framers didn't list that as a disqualifying circumstance. Should he win? What happens? So we have four cases right now. Two are state cases and two are federal cases. A president cannot issue a pardon for state cases. A governor can, or a commutation, depending on what state it is. The governor is the chief executive of a state. So for the two federal cases, one of which relates to January 6th and what's been called, or what is called, the fake elector scheme. I mean, people can frame it however they want to. That's the case I'm referring to. I'm not commenting on the facts or the guilt or the innocence. Look, just like everybody else, President Trump is presumed innocent. That's not a legal fiction. That's something we all take seriously. And I have said that about people that I don't like at all politically. I remember there was somebody when I was in Congress, I didn't like the guy at all. And he was charged, and I said, look, it's important to remember he is presumed innocent. That's a real presumption. So with the federal ones, if he were to win, he could pardon himself. First of all, if he were to win and be inaugurated, I don't think his own Justice Department is going to prosecute him. You can't prosecute a sitting president. That's current DOJ guidance. You won't find that in the Constitution. That's just how the Department of Justice interprets it. You can't prosecute and probably cannot indict a sitting president. where it really gets fascinating to me, Leon, is this. Let's assume he is convicted of state charges after he is elected, but before he is sworn in. What then? You can't pardon yourself of state charges. As a state court judge, I mean, look, I did, as you know, Mary Langston, I did murder cases. I did violent crime cases. I have a pretty different perspective on who ought to be in prison. I don't think, even if you are guilty of falsifying business expenses, I don't think that that's a crime for which you should be imprisoned. I'm really, really big and tough on violent crime. I'm nonviolent crime. I think we ought to be a little more creative than prison. But are you really going to put the president, who, you know, is about to be inaugurated, in state prison? So keep in mind, you cannot pardon yourself of state charges. The Georgia case seems to be like not going very well for the prosecutors for a variety of reasons. I don't think that's going to go to trial before the election. You can't prosecute a sitting president. So the election's going to have a lot to do with what happens with these pending charges. If the president were to run and lose, it would not surprise me if then, I guess, newly reelected Joe Biden pardoned former President Trump for the good of the country. It wouldn't surprise me. But he can't pardon him for the stuff in New York and Georgia, which all gets back to, and this is what I tell kids in the Wofford class that that you help us with and that Sharia teaches. Of all the institutions we have left, you know, if they want to ruin Congress, if they want to turn it into a carnival where, you know, even the Kardashians would be embarrassed, if they want to turn it into an Instagram contest, all the institutions we have left, the justice system cannot be made into a weapon. Because the one day you may view it as a shield, and the next day it may be a sword. And if it can be done to you, the human nature is to want to do it to others. And then we have this, I mean, of all the things that should be above politics. So we're in dangerous territory. The federal stuff is pretty easy. If he wins, he's going to pardon himself. The state stuff, I just cannot see somebody getting an active prison sentence for mislabeling a business expense. I had a reputation as a pretty tough prosecutor. I was not soft on crime. And you want to put people in prison? How about start putting like people that carjack and rob and kidnap and shoot other people? That'd be a good place to start, not business expenses. And the Georgia case seems to be falling apart. But can you run for president? Absolutely. You're presumed innocent. And even if you're convicted, that's not disqualifying for that office.
Well, thank you so much, Trey. And thank you, Leon, for that question as well. Our next question is from CJ in North Carolina, who writes, what would you say are the major philosophical differences between Democrats and Republicans at the local, state, and national level?
You know, that's a great question. I boiled it down to two questions. And as you know, Mary Langston, Sharia and I also teach a class on Congress at Wofford sometimes. And I guess that would be an even numbered years. These are the two questions I want to ask somebody to kind of sort out whether or not they're a Republican or a Democrat. The first question, the one I used to ask, is tell me your view of the nature of humankind, of mankind, of womankind, humankind. What is your view of the nature of it? Do you view, I'm going to use man in the generic sense of the word, Mary Langston. I'm not talking about men. I'm just man in the generic sense of the word, okay? Mm-hmm. Did you view man as inherently good or inherently evil? I think, or I used to think, that Democrats had a more optimistic or hopeful view of the nature of humankind than Republicans. And maybe that was because I was a prosecutor, but that's what I used to think. So again, he's asking the major philosophical differences. Mm-hmm. If you let me ask two questions, question number one used to be, I used to start with, give me your view of the nature of humankind. And if someone says, you remember, well, you weren't in class, and we're talking about the ring of Gyges. If you are invisible and left to your own devices, will you do good or will you do evil? I think people would do bad. I'm a prosecutor. I have a pretty dim view of humankind, and therefore I ran as a Republican. Democrats, to me, or at least the ones I served with, seem to have a more hopeful view of humankind, that if left to their own devices, most people would do good things. That's one philosophical distinction. I don't think I'm right anymore. I don't think that's the right question to ask. I think the right question to ask now is simply this. What is your view of the role of government juxtaposed with the responsibility of the community, the private sector, the individual, the family, and the church? So whose job is it? And increasingly, the answer is government. So in the old days, if I were to say, look, my parents are getting on up in age, they got some health care issues, whose responsibility is it for me to make sure they get the proper health care? I think in the old days, the answer would have been, it's my responsibility. They're my parents, their family. Not anymore. Retirement. Whose job is it to take care of our family members or those around us who maybe have stopped working, they're not able to work, they're physically not able to work? Is that the community's responsibility? Is it the state's responsibility? Is it the church's responsibility? Increasingly, the answer is becoming the federal government. Education. I mean, honestly, if my two kids were uneducated, I would view that as a personal failure. You will never, ever hear me blame a teacher for anything. I don't blame teachers for my inability to do math. It's not my teacher's fault. It's my fault that I'm not smart. You can blame my parents, although they're both pretty good at math. But whose job is it? That's the line of delineation or demarcation in terms of political philosophy. What is the role of government? And I'm not saying this to be dismissive, and I'm saying it to give as honest of an answer as I can to CJ. Democrats have a more expanded view, or have traditionally, of the role of government than Republicans. When I ran for Congress, my little one-sentence mantra was, I believe in a limited federal government that excels at its core responsibilities and inspires public confidence in the process. That was what I ran on, a limited role for the federal government. But you listen to the media, and how do they judge Congress? How many laws did you pass this year? That's how they judge, you know, the least productive Congress in the history of all Congresses, because they only passed X number of bills. Like, it is the federal government's job to solve every problem that we have. That the states can't do it, that the cities and the counties can't do it. I'll give you one more example. I mean, look, South Carolina has a dreadful, dreadful record on the issue of domestic violence. Mm-hmm. We are usually in the top 10 in men killing women. It is a stain on the collective soul of this state, a state that I love. And as I'm sure you've heard me say before, Mary Langston, I will take a backseat to exactly no one on that issue. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of my life standing up for women who had been hurt and killed and otherwise abused by men. But why is that not the responsibility of the state of South Carolina? Why do taxpayers in Idaho have to fund prosecutions of domestic violence cases in South Carolina? That's a state issue to me. But when you say that, you are perceived as being anti-woman or not serious about domestic violence. It is as if the only way we can manifest our concern about something is to federalize it, that the states are incapable of doing it, that municipalities are incapable of doing it, which I find staggering, because the farther you get away from government, or I should say the further you get away from government, the less accountable it is. I mean, can you call somebody in Washington and like get something done locally where you live in Greenville? Probably not. I mean, they might take your call because you're such a kind person. I couldn't get through. I mean, Lindsay and Tim have both blocked me. They won't take my calls anymore. So we local, I want to be able to call my school board. I do know my school board members. I want to be able to call county council. I know the chairman of county council here in Spartanburg. He's a friend of mine. But, you know, it's not good enough. It's not good enough to be a significant local office holder. I got a text late last night, while we were in New York from my sheriff. My sheriff is the chief law enforcement officer in my county. He's the boss. Nobody has a problem with that. Nobody in the world has a problem with the fact that my sheriff is the top law enforcement officer. Nobody has a problem with the fact that Barry Barnett, the district attorney, the circuit solicitor, is the chief prosecutor. We think the state and the county is good enough for that. If it's good enough for a murder case, but God forbid it be good enough for education. Now we got to federalize it. I told you not to let me go on a rant, Mary Langston. I told you to like give me medicine or something to keep me from doing that. But that's the philosophical distinction that I see, the size and scope of government. If you see a big role for government, that tells me one thing. If you see a smaller role for government, but a bigger role for the state or local government or the community or, God forbid, personal responsibility, God forbid it actually be my responsibility to provide for myself, then maybe you lean in another direction politically.
Well, thank you so much for answering that question. Thank you, CJ, for it. We'll answer more of your questions when we come back. Our last question is a little bit more lighthearted, Trey, and it's from William.
Can I guess? It's the death penalty.
I don't know if that'd be lighthearted.
Nuclear war.
Well, it's from William, and he writes, "What is your favorite food?" And he mentions that he and his wife love South Carolina and love the Charleston area.
Oh, wow. So do I. It's a shame that Charleston's not in the state of South Carolina. It's a shame it's its own separate state. And those of us who live in South Carolina refer to it as the state of Charleston. It is a beautiful place, and I hate saying that because more and more people are moving there, and its traffic is awful. That's also true in Greenville now. So, I mean, it is on the one hand, you are so proud of these beautiful cities that we have in South Carolina. On the other hand, you're sitting there thinking, where did this traffic come from? So what is my favorite food? I bet you did not think I could work the death penalty into that question, did you?
I actually can believe it because you always say your death row meal or?
Yeah, my death row meal. Yeah,
okay.
You're exactly right. You know, you should have been one of my kids because you actually listen when I talk. That's what I tell people. But she's a kid, except she listens. Yes, I always tell my wife, we go through this routine a couple of times every week. She'll say, "What do you want for supper?" And not only is she beautiful and sweet and kind, she can actually cook really, really well, which is a hard combination to find. Every now and again, the really, really, really pretty ones don't want to cook spaghetti. But so I always will say, "I want spaghetti." And she'll say, "We had that last night." And I'll say, "No, we had baked spaghetti last night. We can just have regular spaghetti tonight." So she limits it to only like twice a week now. But if I were on death row, you know, you get one meal on death row. Do you know that?
I did not know that officially. I guessed maybe that could be the case, but I didn't know that.
Yeah, and of all the people I think that I have talked to recently, you and Terry would be the least two that would be aware of the fact that you get a meal on death row. But the night before your execution, you get to pick the meal. And so that's why I call it my death row meal. If I were on death row, and I have no plans to be there, but if I were on death row, I would say, sweetie, I want you to make me baked spaghetti with a salad, because she knows I love salad. And then I want my mom to make a cheese ball. And then I want my mom to make me a German chocolate cake. So my favorite meal would be spaghetti, baked spaghetti, made by my wife with a salad. And then my mom to make me a cheese ball where I can watch college sports. And then I'll top it on off right when I hear the footsteps coming to come lead me to wherever I'm going. I top it all off with a piece of German chocolate cake. How's that?
That sounds like a good plan, but we're going to hope and we know that you won't end up being there, but that sounds like a good meal.
I don't know. I mean, we're in college sports season. We've gotten some bad calls and some South Carolina baseball games. And I mean, I'm not planning on anything, but I mean, no, I'm not going to do that. I'll never be on death row, but that's my favorite food. How about you? What is your favorite food? Because, I mean, I've been around you for a decade now. And I mean, your idea of dessert is a Tic Tac.
Not quite. I don't really know what my favorite food would be. I'm not really a foodie, but I guess it depends on the weather too. If it's cold outside, I probably would just love a baked potato or a sweet potato or some good pasta, like you said. If it's warmish outside, I like a good taco. So maybe that with some chamomile tea at some point, and maybe some peanut M&Ms, and we'll call it a day.
I used to buy you peanut M&Ms.
I found out Terry liked them too, and so I would buy them.
But here's my dilemma. Yeah, you both love them, and neither one of you eat them. So guess who winds
sometimes
up eating them? Guess who winds up eating them? The person who doesn't need them. Which is me. So I'm sitting here buying y'all peanut M&Ms and I wind up eating them and it kind of defeats the whole purpose. Can I make one suggestion to you? Because you mentioned you have different foods versus whether it's hot or cold inside.
Okay.
They have this, it's brand new. You probably haven't heard about it. They just came out with it.
Okay.
It's called Central Heating and Air. You can actually keep the temperature the same inside your house, no matter what the weather outside is. You can set it on 70 degrees or whatever you want it to be on. And then you don't have to eat based on what the outside temperature is.
Well, that's just great. So I need to pick one then.
It is.
If I don't have to worry about the weather.
Yeah. And there's no reason you should know that. It is literally brand new. There's no reason you should have known that. But I don't want you foregoing a food that you like because you were sitting outside eating it, okay? You can move inside, and we'll get you a central heating and air system, okay?
Well, thank you for that little piece of advice.
You're welcome. All right. Well, that's it.
That's all we have. That's it.
William wants that happy to note. End with my death row meal. Now we all know it's baked spaghetti.
Well, that's it, Trey. And thank y'all for sending us your questions. We hope you'll keep sending them our way.
I love them. They make me think. Because I had to sit here and think, you know, CJ from North Carolina's question, I mean, it's changed. The line of demarcation between the R's and the D's, at least in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Because I like to sit here and think, because, you know, I mean, I got friends of every political persuasion, and I just, it's just not, that is not like the marker for whether or not I'm going to be friends with someone, and particularly with the Walford class, because you have no idea where those kids are politically.
Right.
If we just got to ask them one question, and then we had to guess whether they were an R or D, what would that one question be?
That's a good question. I would be interested to ask people that are really well-versed in politics like you that question to see what they say, if it was the same question that you pinned or you shared. or if it'd be a different one.
Well, Sharia said I was an idiot.
No, she didn't. She would never say that.
She said the question you should ask is, are you a Republican or a Democrat? Well, I mean, why are you like asking philosophical questions? Just come right out and ask it. But that never entered my mind.
No, she likes psychology and all that kind of thing.
She would never use the word idiot.
No, she wouldn't.
I've never heard her use that word. I don't think she's thought that word. I don't think she's real, but the questions are great. Thank you
yes.
for keeping them coming. And by the time we get together again, we will be on the doorstep of spring. So
and time change, so longer days.
Longer
with the sun,
days. Everything's kind of trending in the right direction. South Carolina, women's and men's basketball are headed towards the NCAA tournament. It's things are trending in a good direction. If Terry listens to our podcast and I survive the comment about her in a fly swatter, then I'll get spaghetti. So it's all going to end up great. And I get to talk to you next week.
That sounds like a great plan. And hopefully she gets past the fly swatter part.
She will, though. Y'all have a great week and you take care of yourself, Mary Langston.
Have a great week. We'll see y'all next Thursday.
Bye-bye. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. And Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. January 26th, 1988 was a cold and suspiciously quiet night at the Indianapolis Police Department, but the frigid night took a chilling turn with news of a triple homicide. This week, I'm joined by retired Sergeant Judd Green for a look back at this savage case. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and FoxNewsPodcast.com.